Thanks for downloading this podcast from The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry, and if you're ready, we'll begin. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. And we sincerely hope that we don't become part of the noise of your day, rather to be among the meaningful sounds in your life. That is surely our aspiration. Music to your ears, best case scenario. Joyful noise at worst.
Who's coming up here?
The question of what is noise and what is music or welcome meaningful sound, that's a philosophical question, and it's part of our focus this hour. We'll also lament the decline of the joyful noises on the playground for American school kids, and we'll contemplate a possibly noisy crowdsourced home life once your smartphone can carry on conversations with the objects in your house. It's coming, folks. Sort noise from meaningful sound in your own life for us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or post a comment at thetakeaway.org. We begin with the persistent fighting and possibly political changes afoot in Ukraine. The election of Ukraine's new president, Petro Poroshenko, in a landslide was answered with a day of bloody clashes and a battle for the airport in the eastern city of Donetsk. The government is reportedly back in control of the airport, and Mr. Poroshenko has reportedly put Donetsk on the top of his list of places to visit in the first days of office, after pledging to end the fighting within hours, not months. He's called the Chocolate King, having made more than $1 billion from his candy empire. The candy man dislikes being called an oligarch, but he is apparently more fond of being called a media mogul as owner of Ukraine's Channel 5 News, the country's main opposition TV station. Wither Ukraine under Poroshenko, freelance reporter Sarah Topol covered his campaign in Kiev for Politico, and she joins me now. Welcome, Sarah.
Thanks very much, John.
What do you think Petro can accomplish here? He certainly has won a significant majority, but it's also of the people who want Ukraine to be independent.
That's a huge problem that he's facing right now. I mean, most of the East was unable to vote. There were zero polling stations open in Donetsk City, which has a population of 1 million people. So he's under a lot of pressure to be able to stabilize the East. And in fact, I guess the first thing that happened after he was elected president was that the pro-Russian separatists tried to take over the airport in Donetsk. And the Ukrainian military launched an operation to root them out. And just recently, they reported that 50 pro-Russian separatist fighters were killed. And so he has to stabilize that region, which is going to be a huge problem since a lot of people there didn't actually vote for him.
What steps can he take? I mean, the question for him right now is how not to further divide the country to possibly, you know, maintain credibility with the Russians themselves. I mean, it's possible that Vladimir Putin will accept him. He certainly said that he would honor the results of this election, although he didn't consider it necessarily terribly legitimate. What can he do to possibly heal the divide rather than widen it?
Well, John, I guess that's the million-dollar question. And I think that one of the things that's really interesting about his candidacy is that it has been his campaign was a lot about unity. And the question is going to be whether or not he is going to put his money where his mouth is. And he said that his first trip as president will be to Donetsk in the eastern region. Whether or not he is able to negotiate with the separatists, who he has in the past called terrorists and compared to Somali pirates, will be a really interesting question. Because while he said that he's willing to negotiate with people in the east, he's also kind of buffered that by saying that he's not willing to negotiate with anyone who's armed and anyone who's not been elected by the people. And if you look at the forces that are destabilizing eastern Ukraine, none of them are elected and all of them are armed.
He's also on record suggesting that Ukraine's future lies with the West, not with the East. Why does he want this job? He's a billionaire.
Well, you know, a lot of people that I spoke to about his past have said that he has always thought of himself as someone who would be a great leader. He has an aura about him that kind of screams, I want power. And throughout his kind of career, he's been, you know, he's been a manager. He's been successful at his past endeavors. And so I think in a way, this was the step forward for him. This isn't the first time that he's sought a very high position in government. In fact, after the Orange Revolution in 2005, it was reported that he was very much gunning for the prime minister position that Yulia Tymoshenko, who just lost to him in this presidential election, was given instead.
Let's see what the first steps would be regarding his fortune. I mean, can he use his chocolate reputation and the jobs that come from that and the investments that he has to bolster his power as president? Or does he have to do sort of a Michael Bloomberg and divest himself of his media assets and other things that he owns?
Well, and this is another really interesting moment in the Ukrainian presidential election. He has gone on record saying that he will step down from his chocolate empire, but he in no way will walk away from Channel 5, which is the independent television channel that he owns. And that has caused some anxiety in Ukraine because it's unorthodox for a president to also continue to control a television channel. And the way that Ukrainian politics has worked in the past, where corruption is really a huge, huge problem, whether or not he's able to change any of that or whether or not it's just the same game as it's been is one of the things that I think the international community is concerned about, and Ukrainians themselves are incredibly concerned about.
Speaking to us from just across the Black Sea from Ukraine, Sarah Topol is a freelance reporter based in Istanbul, Turkey. Thanks, Sarah.
Thanks, John.
For some more insights on what's next for Ukraine, we're joined by Frontline producer James Jones, who's just returned from the region. He has direct experience with the Ukrainian nationalists and the pro-Russian separatists in the east. The possibly ungovernable divisions in this nation are captured in Frontline's The Battle for Ukraine, which airs tonight on PBS. James, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Do you think these divisions are ungovernable? Assess the Poroshenko victory here.
Well, the Poroshenko victory is, you know, that's a sign of optimism. You know, the fact that more than half of the voters united behind one candidate can only be a good thing. And I think probably the reason they did it was because they just wanted to get this over in the first round, move on, and hopefully unite behind him to deal with the separatists in the east.
Well, the markets are certainly supporting the ruble, so this would appear to be a vote for stability as far as Russia's relations with Ukraine are concerned. But you really have the experience of both sides here. Explain what it is you saw. And you got there just as the Crimea annexation was beginning.
Yeah, so I got there just as Yanukovych was fleeing from Kiev. And so it was this great moment. I mean, a lot of people had died, so it was kind of tinged with sadness. But there was this real feeling of optimism that the country could move beyond this corrupt leader. And, you know, most people there seemed to want it to move closer to Europe. And that kind of optimism very quickly evaporated. You know, a few days later, these little green men, as Putin calls them, started turning up in Crimea. And very quickly we saw, you know, what was going to happen there, and Russia annexed it. And then we started seeing the same pattern in the east. And so I traveled out there, and that's where I spent most of my time.
Well, so your mission was really to assess the heroic rhetoric from the Ukrainian nationalists who claim that their country is theirs, even as they see it falling apart. Here's Dmytro Yarosh, one of the leaders of Right Sector, a Ukrainian nationalist group. Listen.
We have a clear attitude to non-Ukrainians in the Ukraine, brotherly to those who stand with us in our struggle for statehood, tolerant of those who live here and don't oppose our fight, hostile to those who do everything to deprive us of our own country. Putin has repeatedly said there is no country as Ukraine, and he does everything to terminate our statehood completely. Every empire is afraid of guerrilla war. That's our way to victory.
Now, Vladimir Putin would interpret that as saying the Russians in Ukraine aren't safe, so therefore they must arm themselves. How do you interpret that?
I interpret that. I mean, Yarosh is a fascinating figure. He's become this kind of hate figure in Russia. Russian television constantly broadcasts images of him as if he is actually leading the government, not Poroshenko. And I think that rhetoric does play into Putin's hands because he shows that to Russian speakers in the east and says, look, this guy thinks you're his enemy. And then because Ukraine's army is not used to fighting battles, they've had to rely on groups like Right Sector to go and fight against the separatists.
Although they were successful in Donetsk today, it seems, in retaking the airport. But if you listen to this rhetoric here, we are tolerant of those who live here and don't oppose our fight. We are hostile to those who do everything to deprive us of our own country. He's really trying to split hairs. This is not ethnic cleansing. This is about people with guns, but Russia isn't going to buy it.
Yeah, I mean, that line to me sounds slightly hollow, you know, to say we tolerate those who, it's, you know, there are nationalists in my country in Britain who say something similar. And you know that there's a kind of sinister undertone to that. And I think certainly Russian speakers in the East will think, well, you know, our idea of Ukraine and your idea of Ukraine is probably quite different.
Well, contrast that with Eagle. And this is the code name of one of the Eastern Ukrainian separatist leaders who you spoke with. We'll listen first.
The Ukrainian nationalists took over the country illegally and began to repress us. We organized our own militia and we attacked the Kharkiv government building on March 1st.
How independent is Eagle? What did he tell you about his relationship with Russia?
Yeah, he was fascinating because he had a genuine feeling that the people who had taken power in Kiev were hostile to him and his Russian-speaking friends and colleagues. But there was something else going on, and he was being paid and organized by Russia. There's a scene in the film of hundreds of Russians attacking the government building in Kharkiv in the east, and, you know, with real violence and beating these 16, 17-year-old kids who'd been holed up inside there. And then to find out that these guys, a lot of them were actually Russian who'd been bussed over that day, and some of them were local kind of street fighters who'd been paid to do it. And you just started to understand that this trouble is not completely organic. You know, there are people pulling the strings.
East and West Ukraine, people on the ground want peace. But in terms of the players that you dealt with, who wants to destabilize the situation and who wants Poroshenko to be successful?
I mean, I think there's no doubt that Putin, as the situation stands, doesn't need to send in his troops. You know, his objective of destabilizing the East has been successful. You know, it's ungovernable. He's proved also that these revolutions don't result in prosperity and stability. They result in chaos and poverty, which is a big thing for Putin. You know, going back to 2004, he wants to show his own people that these kind of popular uprisings lead to disaster.
And so he wants it to not get more unstable, but he's happy the way it is.
He probably doesn't want all-out war. The separatists who are there, who've been banking on his support, are now outnumbered and outgunned, and it doesn't seem like Russia's going to help him. You know, there are a few Chechen fighters in there. There are some kind of ex-Russian military, but they're expecting, you know, thousands of Russian troops to pour over the border. So he's kind of left them hanging a little bit.
So a difficult mission for Poroshenko in the early going as president of Ukraine, but an achievable mission based on your reporting.
Yeah, I mean, he certainly seems to think that he can deal with these separatists. He thinks their support is pretty shallow. He thinks that they are a pretty motley crew who are not well-trained, and the Ukrainian military can beat them pretty quickly. The problem is, you know, there will be death. There will be civilian casualties. And each time that happens, the kind of the fear that's been stoked by the kind of Russian media increases, and that can only lead to more hatred.
Frontline's The Battle for Ukraine airs tonight on PBS. It's produced by James Jones, Frontline producer, just returned from Ukraine. James, thanks so much.
Thanks.
Ah, yes, the joyful din of children on the playground at recess. Did you know in the tranquil nation of Finland, kids get an average of 75 minutes for recess, and it's almost exclusively outdoors. But in the U.S., the average time for recess is right around 27 minutes. Well, that's barely enough time to pick teams for kickball. Recess times have been shrinking along with other extracurricular elements of the school day all around the nation. KUOW education reporter Ann Dornfeld has found a one-minute drop in recess time for Seattle elementary students every year since 2010. We'll check in with her in just a minute. Seattle students, she says, are still above average recess-wise at about 32 minutes a day. In low-income neighborhood schools, the numbers can be lower where recess is seen as a source of discipline problems. But University of Notre Dame psychology professor Darsha Narvaez says play is a source of learning, not a distraction, and restricting it is fraught with problems for child development.
We find that play is an essential part of being a human being, a young human being. It's essential to social life, and it's also essential to physiological and brain development. We know that it promotes beneficial gene expression, brain development, emotion regulation, builds self-control. And we know that mammals who are deficient in play have difficulty with aggression, and those with little play really have altered social life experiences, their sexuality is affected, their conflict interactions with peers are all affected from having little play.
So play sounds like a pretty good ingredient for a well-rounded student performing academically. But Ann Dornfeld, I suspect that you found that in practical terms, administrators of schools in Seattle have difficulty maintaining a high level of recess without experiencing problems.
Right. That's especially true, I found, at schools in low-income neighborhoods. When I first started looking at recess time 4 years ago, I expected that it was being cut back because they wanted to have more academic time in the classroom. But what I quickly learned was that for a lot of the principals I spoke to who are cutting back on recess, they consider recess high time for conflict, and they were trying to avoid discipline problems on the playground.
And that's the story from Vicky Sacco, who's principal of West Seattle Elementary.
When I took over West Seattle Elementary, it had been identified as a failing school. And when I started to investigate where some of the problems were arising, you know, we were starting out, I did some research and recognized that a lot of the issues with behavior, starting there, happened at recess.
And in her research, did she come to a time of recess that seemed ideal to her?
Yeah, she said that from her experience as a principal in other schools, she found that if kids play outside any longer than 15 or 20 minutes where she'd worked, that would lead to a lot of fights. And the longer they were on the playground, the more likely they were to get into scuffles. So she advised her teachers at West Seattle Elementary when she became principal not to let them play any longer than 15 or 20 minutes.
Really, any longer than that, you start to have behavior problems. Kids get involved in a game, somebody hits somebody too hard with a ball, they get angry. So it really minimizes the behaviors. Kids seem happier, and I just think it's better for the instructional day.
Again, that's Vicky Sacco, who's a principal at West Seattle Elementary School. Ann Dornfeld, it sounds to me as though individual principals are taking matters into their own hands, that they have a lot of discretion here. Is there a way of setting statewide guidelines for the use of recess and its importance in educational achievement?
There is, but we've seen that happen with physical education. We have a statewide PE law that mandates 100 minutes of PE on average a week for grades 1 through 8. And when I looked at that recently, I found that I couldn't find a school district that was complying with that law. There was just no enforcement. So, you know, the laws may say one thing, but what schools do is completely different in a lot of cases.
So, Darshia Narvaez, what is the sort of national policy implication here? Is there a way to encourage people to recognize the importance of recess without increasing the number of behavior problems in individual districts, particularly, you know, high crime and troubled districts?
Well, I think we need to educate the educators, because the research also shows that when kids don't have enough play at school, they actually do not make it up after school. So the decreased activity or activity levels in school are actually then carried forward into the rest of their lives. And we know there's huge obesity problems now. And the other issue is that if children are having conflict frequently, it means they're not getting enough play time, because play is the place that children historically and developmentally learned to interact with peers, learn how to cooperate, learn how to resolve conflicts.
I remember when I was in elementary school, Ann Dornfeld, that the recess was a very organized activity. There were people whose responsibility it was to supervise at recess. It wasn't just something that the teachers were forced to do. Is there any evidence that recess is an organized activity in Seattle?
Well, recess is monitored differently in different schools. Our schools have site-based management, so they determine who's doing what. But across the water in Bellevue Public Schools in one of the Seattle suburbs, I found that they're taking a different approach and making recess much more structured. They've contracted with an organization called Playworks that's working across the country to teach schools how to structure recesses, to offer a limited number of games, and students are supposed to pick one of those games. They have school-wide rules, and they have older students monitoring the games to make sure that rules are followed and that disputes are solved with rock, paper, scissors. But not all schools are going to embrace that kind of approach, and I think for good reason.
Actually, that's probably a bad idea. For the last century, developmental psychologists have studied free play, and it's in free play that peers actually develop in the best way. We actually find in a study of 400 adults, and we asked them retrospectively how much they played in childhood and what kind of play they had, that those who had less play overall had poorer physical health as adults, greater anxiety and depression problems. But then we also looked at whether adult-directed play, these structured play activities, had effects. And there really wasn't an effect of adult-directed play on what free play also offered. And that is greater empathy and perspective taking, the building blocks of morality. They had greater compassion and lower aggression if they had free play with peers.
Play, structured and unstructured, and the benefits for childhood education in public schools. Ann Dornfeld, education reporter for KUOW in Seattle. Thanks so much, Ann.
My pleasure.
And thanks to you. Darshia Narvaez is a professor of psychology at Notre Dame, author of The Moral Landscapes blog. Thanks so much.
You're welcome. Thanks. Remember the days at the old schoolyard? We used to laugh a lot. Oh, don't you remember the days at the old schoolyard?
Support for The Takeaway comes from Reputation.com, encouraging everyone to check their online search results because search results define you or your business. Learn more at Reputation.com.
Is it a breakthrough for the kidnapped girls being held by Boko Haram in Nigeria?
The good news for the girls is that we know where they are, but we cannot tell you. Okay, we cannot come and tell you military secrets here. Just leave us alone. We are working. We will get the girls back.
That is the voice of Nigerian Chief of Defense Staff Air Marshal Alex Bade. His official title contains more information, perhaps, than the statement he gave over the long weekend about how the Nigerian military is closing in on Boko Haram. There are also reports of a possible negotiated deal for the release of some of the girls, a deal that was reportedly refused by the government. It's hard to take official statements from the Nigerian government seriously in the best of times, let alone in this kidnapping crisis. But it appears that there may be some engagement right now with the terrorist group Boko Haram, either on the ground or at the negotiating table, or possibly even both. Adam Nossiter is West and Central Africa Bureau Chief for our partner, The New York Times. He's on this story. Adam, thanks for joining us.
Thanks.
So let's talk first about the possibility that the girls, the kidnapped girls, have been located. What's the assessment of that claim from the government?
Well, I think, as you suggested, John, we have to take any pronouncements from the Nigerian government with a great deal of skepticism. They have uttered untruths in the past, and there's no reason to think that this latest announcement from them is any closer to reality than what they've said before.
Does it appear that the government is actually negotiating with Boko Haram, or somebody is, regarding a possible release of some of the girls?
Well, that's possible, yes. I mean, there have been some credible reports that there is a negotiation underway, and the government has not proactively denied that a negotiation is going on. And in addition to which, I've spoken to Nigerian political figures I trust who also assert that some sort of negotiation is going on. Now, as to whether the girls have been located, it's very strange that the Nigerian government would say this publicly. What interest does it serve? Perhaps they're trying to counter the poor image of their military by showing that they're on the case. But in fact, such a pronouncement could be extremely counterproductive.
Let me, throw a speculation up the flag here. I know that's sensitive for you, Adam, but it would appear that perhaps there are some security forces or paramilitaries that are within reach of Boko Haram and that there's some negotiation going on with intermediaries. And the government has expressed some sort of veto in the sense that we heard over the weekend that there was a plan to release 50 and that the government seems to have squelched that. Would that suggest that there is somebody on the ground other than the Nigerian military, possibly?
I don't think so. We know that Western governments are aiding the Nigerians with surveillance and intelligence, but that I think, is the extent of it, at least based on what I know. I mean, if you're suggesting that there are other military forces that have located these girls, I would be surprised. On the other hand, I think that it's possible that some elements of the Nigerian military have come close to locating at least some of them. This is what I heard on the ground, far from the capital, Abuja, and I would tend to believe that.
So it would be hard to even determine how people are taking these reports on the streets of Lagos and other places.
Well, I think that the average Nigerian has a great deal of skepticism also about what their military says and what they do. Unfortunately, the military has shown itself to be, not only inefficient, but also brutal with its own citizens.
Adam Nossiter is the West and Central Africa Bureau Chief for our partner, The New York Times. Thanks so much, Adam.
No problem. My pleasure.
To Capitol Hill now, with little or no concrete action taken by Congress thus far on passing comprehensive immigration reform, Senate Democrat Charles Schumer is lowering the boom on the GOP.
Here's the bottom line. They have about a six-week window from June 10th after the last Republican primary till the August recess. If they don't pass immigration reform then, the president will have no choice but to act on his own.
Whoa. After that six-week window, the Senate Democratic leadership says their ally in the White House will do part of what Congress so far won't. Obama to the rescue to save immigration reform and stem deportations by executive order. Joining us now is Todd Zwillick, Takeaway Washington correspondent. Todd, what's going on?
Hey, John. Well, yes, that deadline from Chuck Schumer, and it's not just his, of course, it also belongs to the leader, to Harry Reid. And you wonder, gosh, what's the significance of from June 10th to the first week of August or the end of July, as Schumer said? Well, June 10th not only is the last Republican primary, but I got a marquee race for you. It's the date of Eric Cantor's primary in Richmond, in Virginia, and he's got a credible primary challenger in the form of economics professor David Bratt. So the idea here is get Republicans out from under their primaries so they don't have to worry about Tea Party challengers anymore on this hot button issue of comprehensive immigration reform. What's the end of July? Well, that's the August recess. That's when Congress goes away. And when Congress comes back after Labor Day, then it's election season. No hope for immigration reform then. So that's the time frame.
So the window, it seems to be about a week. I mean, I guess 6 weeks if you count the whole
thing.
But really, if you wait until the primaries are over, it's really a fairly short period of time for, say, Eric Cantor.
It is. And look, I don't think that Schumer nor Reid nor anybody is really serious about the House Republicans cooking up immigration reform over a six-week window. They don't think that's going to happen. This is political pressure to put on Republicans. And the unilateral action that Schumer is talking about on the part of the president, the White House itself is under a great deal of pressure now. And we've talked about it on this show from immigration groups, in particular immigration groups representing youth. The Obama administration has led the way on deportations in part to try to mollify some of its conservative critics as an olive branch, if you want to call it that, to try to get immigration reform. Now the White House is under pressure to stem those deportations, in particular for illegal immigrants who have families who are naturalized or are citizens or are here legally, because those families are being broken up. And so what you see now is the Department of Homeland Security looking into its enforcement policies, its deportation policy, is going to report back to the White House. And this is Schumer and Reid's window here. Now, why does that matter to Republicans? Of course, we all know the political landscape for 2016. This is Democrats saying, we're trying to keep the focus on you. If you don't come up with something that's dividing you guys now, we're going to make it politically difficult on you. However, listen to Speaker John Boehner here about his reason why Republicans can't deal with Democrats on immigration. It's all about the president. It's all about the president acting unilaterally.
He reduces the confidence of the American people in his willingness to implement an immigration law the way we would pass it. So the president has to rebuild this trust if we're going to be able to do this.
That is, I have to say, and I throw Schumer's remarks in there, impenetrable. I mean, if you're an immigrant family in the United States, you see Obama sort of jacking up the deportation rate and then bringing it down in time for Election Day here, 2014. We saw what the DREAM Act did as an influence on the 2012 election. I mean, that is just cynicism and people's lives in the balance.
With no comprehensive reform to be had. The Senate has, of course, passed its comprehensive bill. It's been, I think about 320 days or so. And the House wants to take a step-by-step approach. Now, Schumer and Reid have their own little gambit for that argument from John Boehner, saying if Republicans just don't trust the president and that's what's standing in the way, let's pass a law and have it go into effect in 2017 when Barack Obama's not president anymore, if that's really your reason. They're calling each other's bluffs right now, John, and of course we're getting into the heart of the political season. There's going to be a great deal of immigration rhetoric over the next 6 weeks, but there may be some policy as well. Eric Cantor and the Republicans want to have automatic citizenship for immigrants who serve in the military, and that's a start, and we're going to see where this goes after that.
All right, we'll be watching. Todd Zwillick, Takeaway Washington correspondent, thanks so much.
You bet.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with The New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
The latest social network may involve your toaster, your thermostat, your closet, and your bathroom. That's an email from your car saying you only have enough fuel to make it to the bridge, not to actually get across it.
Need gas today.
Oh, and your guitar just messaged your phone to tell you it's not in tune. Sales of smartphones are plateauing, and the little devils may be looking for further employment. Apple's got a job for its new smartphones. Analysts and tech watchers say the next step for Apple is to finally deliver on the promise to create a device and a system that can interact with the objects of everyday life, an internet of home tools of things. Oh, we don't want to interrupt that conversation. No. Tim Bradshaw, a San Francisco correspondent for the Financial Times, joins me now. Welcome, Tim.
Thanks for having me on. Hello.
So Apple's principle here, Apple's big idea, and it's not just Apple's, is to try to create a conversation space for smartphones to lead your home and the objects in it to some sort of new relationship with you, right?
Yeah, the idea is a smart home or a connected home that Apple, we're hearing, is going to unveil next week at its annual developer event. And we had Google, which made a move in this area to buy Nest, which was the smart thermostat company you were talking about. Samsung has talked about a smart home which involves its fridges and its cookers and its washing machines. And LG, another Korean electronics company, has even produced a cooker that you can talk to via a chat app called Line. So there's different kind of approaches to this. I think sending actual text messages to your home appliances may not be something that most people want to do. Apple is looking to try and make it easier to set up and control things like lights and security systems, which can be either very fiddly or very expensive if you want to try and make them quote unquote smart at the moment.
Well, as we've discovered, the business model with Apple is to sell all of the devices in the network and, particularly the software if you're looking at iTunes. Samsung's approach is different because they make appliances. LG, as you say, also a little bit different because they make the actual appliances. It seems like this isn't really about technology. It's about the psychology of the users, whether we want to exist in one of these sorts of homes. Who's going to break through here?
Well, so far, there hasn't really been a huge breakthrough in the smart home. There are a few startups that have done pretty well. I think Nest is probably the best known, and that was actually started by a bunch of formal Apple engineers and designers who went on and kind of said, how can we make a thermostat, which is something that lots of people use, but which is kind of clunky, and it was a very kind of Apple-type play, much like they did with the smartphone when they came out with the iPhone. There's another company called Dropcam, which is sort of replaces a kind of CCTV-style home security camera and has a little webcam type thing that you can then look in on from anywhere in the world, and it will send you little alerts when your movement is detected in your home that you perhaps weren't expecting. There's different business models. I think one of the interesting things with Apple doing it, obviously, as you say, they're reliant on selling devices. They want you to buy more of their devices. And again, we're hearing that the Apple TV box, which at the moment is a sort of $99 fairly simple thing, we'll get an upgrade later this year that will play a part in this. And so it's part of Apple's attempt to make you buy lots of different Apple iDevices. Google, on the other hand, mostly actually relies on advertising. And they had a financial filing that came out just last week where it was kind of talking about a multi-device future where they could be serving ads on refrigerators, car dashboards, thermostats, and watches. So I don't know how many people would necessarily want to see ads in their fridge door. But I think there's definitely a role for somebody to come in and kind of clean up what so far has been a fairly scrappy and fragmented market that, as you say, hasn't really persuaded that many people that they need this stuff.
Well, it seems like the design challenge is exactly what happened with USB when that became a standard. All of a sudden, all you need is pretty much one adapter to create a kind of platform for devices to communicate with each other. That's a hardwired approach. Maybe it's up to the appliance makers of the world to come up with a standard platform that will allow computers to interact wirelessly. But so far, we're not there.
Well, we're kind of there. Bluetooth is acting pretty much as the USB for the Internet of Things. Bluetooth came out with a low energy version a few years ago, which most smartphones have had baked into them for the last few years. And that kind of allows for a kind of low battery consumption, kind of easy way for things to kind of get pinged, so that when you walk in with your iPhone in your pocket, it can unlock your door for you and turn on your lights and tell your air conditioning system to boot up, all done via Bluetooth. But what we haven't had is the kind of software platform behind that to coordinate all of those different things. A couple of startups have tried it, but nobody with the heft of an Apple, a Google, or a Samsung. So it's that kind of software layer, and obviously iOS apps don't work on Google Android phones, and there is a sort of competing fiefdoms here that people will want to kind of keep you in their own little family. And for the consumer, it's often better when everything works with everything. And so it will be interesting to see if we get a sort of default standard like Windows was in the PC world, in the Internet of Things. At the moment, it's looking much, much more complicated and fragmented. So,
and we haven't even talked about the Bluetooth burglars, the possibility of that. Tim Bradshaw, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Tim Bradshaw, San Francisco correspondent for the Financial Times.
This is a journey into sound. A journey which along the way will bring to you new color, new dimension, new value.
Need a roadmap for the sounds in your life? A discussion coming up of what is sound versus what is noise. That's next on The Takeaway. But earlier this hour, we had a conversation on whether kids are getting enough time to play during school and make lots of loud sounds. You're commenting on this. Karen in Pawtucket, Rhode Island writes, "When I went to school, recess and gym were considered important. Children learn so much from non-structured free time. Unfortunately, today's education experts are only interested in teaching to the test, and recess and gym are not given sufficient time." Santa Rosa, California says, though, things like recess and physical education have become part of the cuts. This has been proven to be detrimental to the development of children. What do you think about recess? Is there enough time for unstructured play? Should play be structured to prevent discipline problems on playgrounds in public schools? What grade demands more recess versus less recess? Maybe it's time to study for those tests. How does recess compare to when you were young? Have your say at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
We interrupt this broadcast to bring you a special news bulletin from our on-the-spot passport.
Oh, my gosh. The music just turns me on.
The Takeaway is supported by Lumosity.com, the brain training program designed by neuroscientists and used by 50 million people, created to improve memory and attention. More at Lumosity.com.
Quiet moment in New Orleans has very little white noise if you are on the streets of the French Quarter. Traffic layered on Dixieland, layered on dancing, street life, and the boisterous sounds of restaurants, clubs, and bars. New Orleans is a city of sound. Or is it a din of noise? When does the jazz band cease to be music and become an oppressive force assaulting city dwellers? Sorting noise from music, streetscape soundtrack from din, is an old argument. And with technology, we can try and win that argument all on our own. Noise can be canceled with fancy new headphones. But what are they canceling? And is the canceling of noise also the erasing of culture? Megan Garber, a staff writer at The Atlantic, has some thoughts on technology, noise, and noise canceling in a city where not even Hurricane Katrina canceled Mardi Gras. Her story is called Sonic Boom, How Digital Technology is Transforming Our Relationship with Sound.
Noise is just so pervasive in our lives, and it's something I think that we want to control. Humans, I think, throughout history have tried to control noise in certain ways. You can look at music. In some ways, that's an attempt to control noise. But, you know, we've tried to sort of construct towns in ways that would allow us to control the noises of bells and how far bells could reach and things like that. And so it's, I think, in some ways, human history has been kind of a story of human attempts to sort of either amplify or cancel out certain noises.
You're describing something that's very, very familiar, but you know, the assumption in a noise-canceling device is that somehow we know the difference between what is noise and what is sound, and we actually don't, do we?
That's true. We don't. And it's actually very subjective. So, you know, one person's music is another person's noise. And it really does vary. There are cultural variations. There are age variations. So, it's actually a very sort of politically fraught question. What is noise versus what is sound? And what, do we want to regulate and try to control? And what do we just sort of accept as, just an aspect of modern life?
It's a really deep cultural question down in New Orleans where you set your story in the Atlantic. And it really reminded me of when I used to do television. We shot a story about Anne Rice, the writer who lives in New Orleans. And we would do these live shots on the street trying to get, a little video vignette shot on the street. And it was so difficult in New Orleans because there was always just some honk or a trumpet or, any kind of sound could disrupt what we were trying to do. And you brought all of that back in this story.
Every city is going to have its particular noises and soundscape. But New Orleans, because it so identifies with its music, it's just really a noisy place and a sound-filled place. And these two things, the noise and the sound, are sort of in constant dialogue and occasionally competition with each other.
Does technology liberate people from noise, or does it create walls between people in a place like New Orleans?
I mean, I think both are true. Certainly in New Orleans, they've attempted to regulate noise, and I think it's been a very difficult thing for them to do just because there are so many sort of politically and culturally fraught questions that surround it. But I think on a broader scale, technology is a way that we use to create noise. So it certainly, allows us to sort of create noise in that way. But also it is something that we've been experimenting with when it comes to limiting noise and to sort of, protecting ourselves against the onslaught of sort of aural weapons and things like that, where we can just say, I'm going to put on my noise-canceling headphones and I'm not going to hear the trumpeting on the street that I don't particularly want to hear right now, or I'm not going to hear the person who's yelling on the subway this morning. I'm just going to listen to my own music, and that will be that.
There's this, imprecise but, again, very familiar notion of peace and tranquility that in the law goes back to the 1800s. And I'm wondering if what you're finding is that these acoustic technology companies have sort of gravitated to this idea of peace and tranquility and are trying to manufacture it in the form of a product.
I think that's absolutely right in some ways. And I think they do it with a lot of respect to how subjective that idea of peace and tranquility can be in the first place. But there are certainly companies right now that are sort of taking advantage of digital technologies and digital affordances to try to create personal soundscapes, basically, and to help architects engineer rooms that will be sort of ideally calibrated for certain noises. So there's a lot of thinking right now going into how do we sort of calibrate our shared public spaces to create noises that will be sort of best for everyone, basically, and that will make everyone happy and not annoyed.
How is the story of trying to, get more peace and tranquility in New Orleans, the story of seeking out what are called C-weighted sounds?
So basically, there are many different types of sounds that the human ear can hear. And C-weighted sounds are the ones that are the low sounds that can kind of, it's like subwoofer sounds that kind of hum at this very low level. And those can be particularly annoying to people. So basically, audio engineers and acousticians are trying to pay a lot of attention to the subtle nuances of different noises so that they can sort of say, okay, well, a high-pitched noise is going to be very frustrating to people. So let's really try to regulate the high pitch noises, and let's really try to regulate the lower pitch noises and try to actually pay attention to those subtleties in the noise. So it's not just a matter of decibels and loudness, but it's actually a matter of psychologically what really gets on people's nerves. And it really does, I think, illustrate, those different types of noises that exist. There's the nts of the clubs, and then there's the different noises of the street musicians, and then the honkings of horns on the street, and the, talking of people on the street, and all of that. So they're trying to find ways to sort of let all of that coexist in a way that will be, in this subjective way, peaceful to the nearby residents of New Orleans.
As a journalist, how many times have you said, and could you repeat that, the oomph oomph of the clubs?
Yes, and I should have said oomph oomph is actually how it goes. Yep.
So part of the story that you tell here is how these acousticians and these city councils that are trying to control sound and noise need to get a sort of baseline map of what their city, their place sounds like. And there are these things called soundscapes that are associated with particular places. As a journalist, how historically important of an artifact do you think something like a soundscape is?
You know, I think it's very important, actually. One of the things that interested me about learning more about this story was just the idea that we tend to think so visually when it comes to history. And I love the idea that recent technologies have allowed us to think much more strategically and archivally about the sounds of the world. And so for me, I love the idea that we now have, recordings of New York City in the 1920s and the 1930s. And there are academics who are doing work in this area to really gather those recordings together and archive them. And I love to, know how the world sounded back then, how New York sounded back then, and to actually hear that, I think journalistically and just, as a person, I find it so interesting to have that extra dimension of historical knowledge.
Megan Garbert's a staff writer at The Atlantic. She wrote about sound in her piece for The Atlantic called Sonic Boom, How Digital Technology is Transforming Our Relationship with Sound. Sound says a lot. What would be the sounds that make up the soundscape of your community? Here's a story from Karina from Miami, Florida, writing about Washington, D.C. When I lived there, I became a regular at the drummings in Malcolm X Park. For nearly 30 years prior, drummings had brought together African Americans, Africans, and Latino Afro descendants for a kind of communion and fellowship in a city that was increasingly gentrifying and changing, forcing many longtime residents to move away. The gathering wasn't just about sharing rhythms. It was deeper than that, a kind of holding on. This week we have a project for you. Record the sounds of your city and tell us, is it noise or is it sound? You can email us your MP3 or your city's sounds to takeawayaudio@gmail.com. All one word, that's takeawayaudio@gmail.com. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry, and this has been The Sounds of The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Reputation.com, encouraging everyone to check their online search results, because search results define you or your business. Learn more at Reputation.com. TiVo, able to search cable TV, on-demand libraries, and streaming content from Netflix and Hulu Plus on a single screen. Available at TiVo.com. The Henry Luce Foundation, for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. And the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.